From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today we're bringing you Lake Effect from inside the Panther Arena in downtown Milwaukee. On the final day of the convention, we'll wrap up the sights, sounds, and conversations we saw inside the perimeter. We'll hear reaction to the convention from the chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party.
It's the addition of all the different kinds of campaigning and all the different arguments that you can make that add up to a hairline victory in a state like Wisconsin that's divided 50-50. I don't think we're in an era where there are political earthquakes that actually drastically move the needle into landslide territory in a big election.
We'll look at what kind of sway a vice presidential pick can have on voters.
Instead of the VP being some chance to peel people off with a more popular figure, instead they've become so closely aligned with the presidential candidate that people kind of throw up their hands and say, well, that's not doing it for me either.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. It's obviously been an all-hands-on-deck situation for this Republican National Convention here in Milwaukee. We've got NPR reporters here in our city covering fact checks, overarching themes, and notable convention speakers. Then we've had our entire local team adding Milwaukee color to what is really the first in-person national political convention for a major party in our city. WUWM's Mayon Silver is a general assignment reporter whose unofficial beat has been voters and the 2024 election. This week, she's been getting the lay of the land both inside and outside of the security perimeter. We wanted to get some of her observations of these past few whirlwind days, and she joins me now. Hello, Mayon.
Hello there.
So first of all, when this week started, what were you most interested in with this political convention coming here to Milwaukee, and has anything surprised you?
So, you know, what was most surprising, of course, was the assassination attempt a few days before the convention. I think that's the case for everybody. But it's been interesting to watch how the convention has really gone on as planned. But second to that, I've been most interested in how this big pep rally for a conservative presidential nominee, as controversial as former President Trump, was going to intersect with a city like Milwaukee that has a big Democratic base.
Right, right. So on that last point, what have you noticed about moving from in and out of the convention grounds?
Well, to set up the picture here, you know, as people have probably been saying all week, inside the security zone where we are now, it's highly policed. It's like going through airport security. And outside of the convention, like downtown, Milwaukee has sort of been weirdly fenced and blockaded. It's kind of felt like a ghost town in parts. It's been getting better as days go on, but one of our colleagues, Taryn Powell, said that it's giving early pandemic.
Yeah, I agree.
Yes. And so, you know, I knew that some people living here in Milwaukee would have preconceived notions about what it would mean having a whole lot of Republicans come to town. Some left the city, others are avoiding it. But I didn't think about it from the other angle, that there's a little bit of mistrust on both ends. And inside the hard zone, I ran into Kathy Doyle. She's a delegate from Pennsylvania. She spoke to this.
Our days are pretty booked with the convention, and then we do have special, each state has their own little events that they're having. So we just had one here at Doc's Smokehouse, which was excellent, by the way. And then we have this afternoon, we have our sessions back at the convention center. So there really hasn't been a lot of time to do any sightseeing, and it really hasn't been, I say, encouraged, I think just for our own protection, because of a lot of the political rhetoric that's out there that triggers some people that can't separate the politics rhetoric, and they perceive people as real threats.
So Doyle says she feels safe in the hard zone and at her hotel, but not really elsewhere because of the overarching feeling of political discord in the country. So that surprised me coming at it from that angle that, you know, there's kind of a trepidation there.
Yeah, yeah. But I hope that's not the case for all delegates that you've spoken with and seen throughout this week, right?
No, so you're right about that. So buses and streetcars have been fairly empty, like we were talking about before, but Milwaukee journalist Dan Schaefer posted on X about a guy, a delegate who was navigating the bus system in Milwaukee and riding it all around town. That was kind of fun to see. I've also seen delegates enjoying themselves out and about in downtown in the Third Ward. One was Tara Peters. She's a delegate from Missouri. And she says she and her crew, she says they're being a bit more adventurous these days.
I want to tell you that we kind of just was talking on the way a few minutes ago, that I think that they've come to you all and said, I need you to pretend like it's Whoville, because you have all been like extremely like over the top kind. Like if we're walking down the sidewalk, people are being very gracious, greeting us, hey, can I help you? So I don't know if you guys are getting paid or you got a really big pep talk before we got here, but you are rocking it. It has been amazing.
So it sounds like Tara wasn't letting politics stop her from exploring, which is nice. But back to the safety concerns of Milwaukeeans. Since the RNC was announced as a possibility in Milwaukee, a lot of local activists took issue with the idea of increased police presence here. They've been worried about the influx of officers from out of state who don't understand or know the community. And that worry materialized this week when five Columbus, Ohio officers shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr. in Milwaukee's King Park neighborhood.
Right, and on that note, we will hear an interview from Eric Von Fellow, Nadia Kelly, about this ongoing story. She's going to be speaking with Angela Lang of Black Leaders Organizing for Our Communities, who wants the city to be held accountable. So, Mayan, we've discussed what the scenes have been like out and about, but on the inside of the convention floor, it sounds like Republicans have been really focusing on this whole theme of unity. But how has that actually been received?
So Republicans I've been talking to have really been upbeat and excited about this convention. They're united around Trump, the people that are here. They're, you know, mostly supportive of his VP pick, J.D. Vance. But of course, as we said earlier, this is a pep rally. That's what's supposed to happen. And it's a very self-selecting crowd. The people here in this convention may be more unified, but how are they going to bridge that to people who are not already on board with Trump and MAGA? And Keith Gillikes is a GOP strategist in Madison, and he spoke at a WISC politics event earlier this week and said he worries about conventions making a party overconfident and says the GOP is still behind on infrastructure. He was warning about that and said, you know, he told people, quote, we've got a lot of work to do.
Did you hear from any Republicans about how they want to harness their energy here from the convention to go out and convince local voters to vote for the GOP months from now?
Well, we've done some reporting about conservatives' efforts in Wisconsin to really try and go after those people who lean conservative and, you know, might be receptive to their message but don't vote often. They want to win back some people they lost in the suburbs in 2020. And in Milwaukee County in particular, they want to close in on the Democratic margins of victory because, you know, we've been told that like 50% of the vote in Wisconsin comes from about 10 counties. Milwaukee's the biggest county. So the Milwaukee County GOP chair has called it losing by less. But I spoke with Cindy Werner. She's a delegate. This year, it's actually her fifth convention. And she's also with the Milwaukee GOP. This is what she said about it. Do you feel like this is mobilizing you for the rest of the year?
When you say this, are you talking about the convention?
Convention.
No, I was already mobilized. We already had a plan of... And the plan is move the needle in Milwaukee, focusing on areas that we can change and we can make a difference in Milwaukee.
So, you know, Cindy and others, they say they're doing this with data and relational organizing, neighbors talking to neighbors. They say they're doing tabling at events in the community, but we'll see come November how effective it is.
So on the other side of mobilization, we'll be hearing from Ben Wickler, the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, soon about the polarization. But before we get to that, Mayan, are there any other details you can share about the convention?
So there's a street fair right outside of the Fiserv Forum called Delegate Fest or Convention Fest, and it's got food and informational booths and vendors. And Tolu Ojeshinu is a Milwaukee businesswoman from Nigeria who sells colorful head wraps currently in the Delegate Fest. You know, it's just a nice pop of color there. She's got necklaces. And she told me she's had some fun interactions at her booth at Delegate Fest. And do you talk politics with people?
Oh, no. I prefer to make friends. And it is hard to talk politics and make friends sometimes.
So she said that she has a lot of friends, and it's because she doesn't talk politics. But it's just kind of a reminder that sometimes art and culture is a bridge that people need and not politics.
Even in the grounds of the RNC, totally. So you've not only been checking out what's on the scene here this week, but you've also been very busy representing WUWM and Milwaukee to outside media organizations. So first off, big shout out to you. You've talked to people like CNN International, North Carolina Public Radio, and BBC Business. So what are these organizations from far and wide curious about?
Yes, this has been fun. You know, that coverage, CNN was kind of interested in the bigger picture of politics in the swing state of Wisconsin, and they wanted like a short overview of the atmosphere here, you know, in Milwaukee as a whole, the protests. North Carolina Public Radio has a politics show, and they were interested in, you know, they wanted to talk about any changes that were coming to the RNC after the assassination attempt and what would be the mark of a successful convention. And then BBC Businesses wanted some tape from local businesses about what they're thinking about the convention and about politics this year.
Certainly shows that there's more ways than one to look at this convention, as we've been doing all week.
Indeed.
So while the RNC is wrapping up today in Milwaukee, Chicago is getting ready to host the DNC next month. And Mayan, you spoke to Ben Wickler, who is the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin this week, right?
Yes, I spoke with him for his take on the convention, the GOP convention. We talked about political violence and division in this country and the status of President Biden's reelection campaign. I first asked him what he thought of the appearance of Sean O'Brien at the RNC on Monday night. O'Brien is the president of the Teamsters, one of the country's largest unions, and they advocate for workers' rights, and they've actually endorsed Democratic presidential candidates since Bill Clinton. Here's what Wickler had to say.
One thing that was so striking to me was the tepid applause from the crowd at the Republican National Convention when the labor leader was talking about corporate welfare, talking about supporting unions and the power of workers. This is something that you could see the Republican Party simply is not united on. And at the Democratic Convention, I can guarantee you, when we hear labor leaders speak and champion the rights of workers to organize and make life better for themselves and their families, Democrats will be on their feet. This is a uniting core value for Democrats, that we believe in unions, we believe in working people, and we think that those who work hard for their families should be able to support those families. On the GOP side, it is this big debate over, you know, whether to expand corporate welfare and multi-trillion dollar tax cuts for the wealthiest people in the country. That's what Trump is promising. That's the line that gets the Republican delegates to their feet. And it's frankly not something that most Americans want.
And you and I haven't talked since the assassination attempt on Trump, but, you know, I kind of wanted to know, have you been doing in press conferences, like talking about the rhetoric and the divisions in this country? You've been talking about that a lot or not really?
I posted on Twitter on the night of that shocking and horrible attack on former President Trump, the attack that cost the life of one of Trump's supporters who was trying to protect his family and put two other people into critical condition. Political violence has no place in this country. It is one of the sorriest aspects of our history. And every attack on a candidate, on a former elected official or current elected official is an attack on the idea of democracy in this country. In this country, we fought a revolution so that we could decide who holds power based on ballots, not based on bullets. And the core thing in this election, one of the core issues, is whether we will continue to be a country where the defining question is who can earn the support from the public. That's part of why Democrats are so determined and united to defeat Donald Trump in the election, because of his role in an act of political violence on January 6th. And if we want to uphold that principle, it is critical that everyone join together to denounce the horrible attacks like the one that we saw last Saturday.
And the thing about Democrats is that a lot of people are talking about the fact that they see Trump as a threat to democracy. They look at his record and the things that he's said and the Project 2025 and all the things that they're concerned about, and the fact that he's had a role in tamping up the rhetoric in this country. How do you reconcile that as a Democrat and the fact that he was also just a victim of something like that? Something that some Democrats feel arguably he's contributed to the tone and tenor.
Political violence is, it's always a tragedy. And no one deserves to be shot at across this country. And it's critical to defeat threats to democracy through democracy. The way that we defeat someone who wants to be a dictator on day one, as Trump put it, is to defeat that person at the ballot box. I think it should inspire people to work harder, to organize through peaceful, civil, legal means to make sure that people who want to thwart democracy or want to foment violence don't have access to official power. And I think it's a somber reminder that the demon of violence haunts our country. It goes back hundreds of years. We've had multiple presidents who fell victim to assassins' bullets. This is something that we need to turn the page on. And the way that we do that is by electing people who represent what's best in us. It is through the work of democracy, of knocking on doors and talking to friends and neighbors, that we make sure that people who embrace the values of the peaceful transfer of power and the sovereignty of the people of the United States of America, that those are the folks who hold public office.
And you and I had talked once in 2023 about how, as Democrats knocking on doors for the then state Supreme Court race, you felt like sometimes you can't expect that people have read the same newspapers. You can't expect that they're on the same page as you. It's a totally different reality in some senses. Do you still feel like that? And how do you bridge that? And how are you bridging that?
We're in an era of shattered attention. And that doesn't just mean at the individual level how all of us feel like we're distracted all the time with notifications on our phones. It's at the level of a society. So many people are paying attention to so many different things at any given moment. So many people trust different messengers. They have not only different opinions and values, but different facts. And you have to start with recognizing that and then working to reach people through trusted messengers wherever it is that they're getting the information that they put their faith in. And for some people, that's their friends. For some people, that's a pastor. For some people, that's an athlete or another public figure that they look up to. Some people answer the phone. Some people open the door. Some people don't do either of those things, but they're listening to podcasts 24/7. You have to go where the people are, and the people are spread out all over the place. And that's the complexity of politics in this moment. But it's also why, in a weird way, things that seem absolutely game-changing to one person are barely a blip to another person. And in a way, it's the addition of all the different kinds of campaigning and all the different arguments that you can make that add up to a hairline victory in a state like Wisconsin that's divided 50-50. I don't think we're in an era where there are political earthquakes that actually drastically move the needle into landslide territory in a big election. This is a game of inches, and you have to keep on doing the work day in and day out to have a shot of winning.
On that note, you know, the DNC is coming up. President Biden is currently the presumptive nominee. New York Times is reporting things like that there's a historic standoff between Mr. Biden and his small inner circle, and broad swaths of voters and elected Democrats fearful of an electoral wipeout in November. On the other, there's been a lot of conversation about Biden as a candidate. Where are you at right now on that?
President Biden is our nominee. President Biden has a record that demonstrates his values, his patriotism, his decency, his respect for working people, and his determination to fight to expand freedom. And the pro-freedom, pro-democracy, pro-worker message of Democrats that won in 2020 and 2022 and 2023, that can prevail again this November. I am proud to be the leader of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin delegation to the National Convention, where we'll officially nominate and lift up Joe Biden as our nominee. And then it is on to November. So many people who are concerned about the presidential race, who are, you know, quoted in these news stories, they are absolutely clear that they'll do everything in their power to help support our nominee to defeat Donald Trump. And they're reading all the same news that you just quoted, and they're having all kinds of debates. And then ultimately, they're ready to do whatever it takes, because person after person has said to me, they know what an effective president Joe Biden has been. And the top most thing in their mind is, what is the path to making sure that they defeat Donald Trump this fall? So I look forward to, there's a healthy debate happening that happens in a healthy Democratic Party, small D Democratic Party, unlike what we saw on the Republican side. And then we'll come together and we'll support Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and win on November 5th.
So you don't see any sort of crazy upset happening at the DNC?
I think we had a nationwide primary. President Biden won overwhelmingly. He has something like 99% of the delegates, and the delegates are going to cast their pledged delegate votes for Joe Biden, and he will be our nominee this November.
Mm-hmm. Ben Wickler is the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. Mayon, thank you so much for being here with me today at the Panther Arena. Appreciate it so much. Good work.
Thank you.
In about 10 minutes, we'll hear reaction from local organizers about this week's shooting of a Milwaukee man by Ohio police officers. But first, we'll talk about running mates and why they don't deliver elections or a particular group of voters. Learn more coming up next on Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski in the Panther Arena in downtown Milwaukee. Vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance gave his speech at the RNC last night. Trump's running mate just joined the U.S. Senate representing Ohio in January of last year and never held a political office before that. Now that the 39-year-old has been catapulted onto the national stage, will Trump's VP pick have the power to bring in any voters or end up costing the Republicans votes? To talk more about the impact of running mates, I'm joined by Christopher Devine, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Dayton and co-author of Do Running Mates Matter? Devine begins by giving his initial thoughts on J.D. Vance as the VP pick.
It's not as clear from his record what to expect from him. And so voters typically want someone who has more experience and clearer qualifications, someone they can be sure that, in this case, 6 months from now, could take over the vice presidency or even the presidency if necessary. And I think Trump passing over people like, let's say, Marco Rubio has a quarter century of federal, state, and local experience, knows politics very well. That would have been someone who would have been clearly qualified for office. I don't think anyone would have a question about it. J.D. Vance, they will. And I think that might bring up questions, even though we know a lot about Donald Trump, it might bring up questions about, you know, how serious is he about governing this time around? Or is he going to be focused on kind of personal politics, revenge and retribution, as he's talked about it sometimes? I think that is a little of a wild card for Americans.
Yeah, obviously there's a different feel for it blocks from us in the Pfizer. But for the broader American public, do you think Vance as Trump's running mate will help or hinder the reelection chances? There's a long time between now and the election.
Yeah. Well, first, you're absolutely right that for the delegates at the convention right now, for Republicans generally, J.D. Vance is a popular figure. I can tell you in recent years, if you look at the data, the popularity of vice presidential candidates, my co-author and I, Kyle Kopka, we've documented a trend here where you see that vice presidential candidates over time have become less popular. They're less of a way of appealing to Americans, you know, kind of broadly. They're really popular within their own party. In fact, Mike Pence and Kamala Harris, for the data since 1968, 1968 to 2020, they were the most popular running mates within their own party. They were the least popular with the other party. In fact, by 15 points out of 100, they were lower. And with independents, they were, I think, the second least popular. So, you know, there's a trend towards loving your own running mate, your own party's running mate, but really not liking the opposite parties. And then for those folks who are in the middle, instead of the VP being some chance to peel people off with a more popular figure, instead they've become so closely aligned with the presidential candidate that people kind of throw up their hands and say, well, that's not doing it for me either.
Right. So the book you've been referencing is the one you co-wrote called Do Running Mates Matter? And I'm wondering, can you just go over some of the data that you're studying and some of the key takeaways that we might have not already talked about when it comes to the whole concept of running mates?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So there's a wealth of data in there. So, you know, the short version of it is that we really look at three different ways that people talk about running mates mattering, three different ways that could impact how people vote. And the first one is what we call direct effects, the idea that because, let's say, you really like J.D. Vance or you really dislike him, that you might be that much more likely to vote for or vote against the ticket. You hear people say, for example, hey, I was thinking of voting for John McCain, but then he picked Sarah Palin and I really didn't like her, so I didn't vote for the ticket. People say that. Well, you know, there's a lot of times people feel like that's what motivated them. But from a political science standpoint, we often find that, you know, it's not clear. Maybe they're already headed in that direction. They just wanted to, you know, anchor that to a certain specific thing. They could say, oh, that's what did it for me. So first, these direct effects of voting differently because you like or dislike the vice presidential candidate. We don't see much evidence of that. Likewise, when we look at what we call targeted effects. So maybe it's not that this person's going to really help or hurt with the electorate as a whole, but a certain group of people. You know, Tim Kaine in 2016, maybe he'll appeal to Catholics the same way that we're hearing that, hey, maybe J.D. Vance will appeal to Catholic voters, right? When you look at the data for it, and we do it in a pretty rigorous way, we show, I think, pretty clearly that there was not a movement toward those candidates, their ticket, you know, among these certain groups of voters, evangelicals, for example, for Pence in 2016. The only exception, by the way, is Kamala Harris in 2020, which this case came after the book in a separate analysis. We looked at this. She did seem to help with women voters and black voters, but not by that much. Where running mates really matter is kind of what I was referencing before. We call these indirect effects, that they can influence how people think about the presidential candidate because that's who they're actually voting for. I mean, sure, we're electing this ticket, but who's going to choose their less preferred presidential candidate just so I can get that vice president in office? I'd love to see that person be vice president. I don't think many people do that. So they're focusing on the presidential candidate, but their sense of who that person is can be shaped by the choice of a running mate because, again, that's often called the first presidential act. It's a major personnel decision that they make during the campaign. And yeah, it just tells you a lot about who the presidential candidate is.
Yeah. So going on those indirect effects and that theme, Vance will have little appeal to voters outside of this Republican base. Do you think it could go as far as costing Trump votes or hindering things?
I think it will cost him overall. I don't think it'll be by a lot. You know, Kyle Kopko and I, our general conclusion is that, yeah, running mates matter, but let's not overstate things. They're probably not going to be game changers. That's just an unrealistic expectation. I think J.D. Vance is going to help with certain folks. I think he is going to absolutely engage and motivate Republicans, people who already were fond of Donald Trump. But outside of the coalition, what's the appeal that they weren't already getting from Donald Trump? This is not to say inherently there's something wrong with J.D. Vance. I mean, that might depend on folks' politics. But who out there doesn't like Donald Trump's politics but likes J.D. Vance's? They're kind of too similar for that. And you also don't have that appeal of, you know, demonstrated competence in the job because he is relatively lacking in experience. And it's not that people necessarily again, you know, vote for a VP or wow, I just really like, you know, wow, Marco Rubio has so much experience. That'd be wonderful if he was VP, right? But I think people do respond to a failure on the presidential candidate's part to pick someone who meets kind of their normal standards. J.D. Vance, I've described him, and I'm reluctant to say it, but I just think it's true. He's the least qualified vice presidential candidate in modern history, even to a greater degree than Sarah Palin, who, by the way, had served for nearly a decade in local and state office before she was governor for 2 years at the time of her selection. John Edwards was a freshman senator in 04. I don't think he was a great pick at all, but he was in the sixth year of his first term and had also done pretty well in presidential primary. So J.D. Vance is conspicuous and lacking experience, more so than any recent running mate. And while there are other things that folks are considering, he's being scrutinized for his positions. Abortion especially has come up this week in some Democratic attacks on him. I think folks will eventually get around to discussing this question. Hey, is this guy ready to take over as president potentially 6 months from now?
I mean, we can call it ambivalence at best, right, mm-hmm. when it comes to VP picks. And another thing I want to touch upon in regarding the unpopularity that exists with something with VP candidates in general is something you call the Veep stakes. So can you explain that?
Yeah, the Veep stakes kind of gets to this period that we're really just concluding now that we know who the pick is. And it wasn't always this way. It used to be the case that at a convention, we would find out who the presidential candidate was going to be. And technically, formally, that's still true. But back then, we didn't have the situation where delegates came to the convention bound, required to vote for whoever won the primary in their state. There were still primaries, but they were often called beauty contests. You know, it didn't actually bind the delegates. And so because we didn't know until the convention the presidential candidate was going to be, we also didn't know who the vice presidential candidate would be. And often there was this matching that would go on, balancing as it's called, like, okay, well, if this person got the presidential nomination, then we should pick a person from this part of the country for the VP nomination and so on. So there wasn't really an opportunity to scrutinize the potential VPs. Well, in the early 1970s, we get these reforms to the parties, which, you know, short version of it, we do get delegates who are bound by primary results. And so they show up committed to voting for a certain presidential candidate. And that means, just like this time around, we know months in advance that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican candidate. We think we knew months in advance that Joe Biden's going to be the Democratic candidate. It still seems like it's in flux. I mean, I don't know. We'll see there. But at least for Trump's purposes, he had these months in between where we all knew he's going to have the choice to scrutinize various candidates, go through a vetting process and even publicly leak names to kind of gauge reactions to them. And that's really what we call the Veep Stakes, kind of a silly name for it, right? It's not a sweepstakes. They're not just getting lucky and getting picked for this. But it kind of fits with what I've described as this game-like quality to discussing this actually very serious, very important choice, where, you know, it's almost like this parlor game that people play, and we're just seeing its conclusion now, where the speculation has ended and we know who the running mate is.
Yeah, and it's more about who might help someone win an election rather than how can they help govern.
Yeah, I think that's really unfortunate. Thanks for bringing that up. And that's there was a book that I wrote more recently. The subtitle is What's Wrong with the Veep Stakes. The actual title is more boring. But, what's wrong with the Veep Stakes, okay? Not the selection process itself, but the way we talk about it. And this is a much more responsible discussion, but broadly what happens in news media is this not very serious discussion of who should win that focuses way too much on who can help in the election, as if it doesn't even matter how this person would perform once in office. I think it's really unfortunate that in that process, there's not nearly enough attention to who's qualified to be vice president of the United States, or again, president if necessary. And for example, just to throw one quick fact at you. So I examined media coverage of the Veep Stakes over the period from 2000 to 2020 and kind of categorized all the things that they would talk about when you see these profiles, like what about Marco Rubio, Doug Burgum, Tom Cotton, Tim Scott, Lisa Stefanik? What things do they discuss? And what I found is that about 5% of them, these media profiles, specifically discuss whether this person actually qualified for the job. And that was about the same percentage, actually a little lower than the percentage that discussed their physical appearance. Okay? You know, yeah. It's like kind of funny, but kind of not.
Yeah.
They're as likely to talk about their looks in a positive or negative way than they are to talk about, hey, is this person even up to the job? You know, I hope that changes.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join me. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Christopher Devine is an associate professor of political science at the University of Dayton and co-author of Do Running Mates Matter? You can listen to our extended conversation at wuwm.com. On Tuesday afternoon, the second day of the Republican National Convention, five Ohio police officers shot and killed an unhoused man about a mile away from the convention grounds. It happened in the King Park neighborhood and has sparked outrage amongst community members and organizers. Angela Lang is the executive director of the nonprofit BLOC, which stands for Black Leaders Organizing for Our Communities. She joins WUWM Eric Vaughn fellow Nadia Kelly to talk about the incident and why she feels it could have been avoided.
I'm just really curious to hear what concerns you had going into the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, you know, some of the concerns I had definitely given the political landscape was political violence. And these were things that I was saying before the attempted assassination of former President Trump on Saturday. I think there's a certain reality that things are incredibly tense right now. And how does that spill over into our elections and politically motivated violence? And that was a big concern. I know myself and other organizers, we're always concerned with large conventions and what does it look like to support unhoused folks or other folks that may be downtown in the area? How are we protecting local folks and the local communities as well? What does the increased security look like? And understanding that there's multiple law enforcement agencies from out of town that are unfamiliar with our city and its residents and what all of that looks like. In the days leading up and as the security perimeter was announced, you know, even organizations and groups like St. Ben's that largely a lot of the folks that they service are unhoused. Some may have mental health challenges. They're right in the security perimeter. So there's additional police and law enforcement. And that didn't seem like a recipe for anything successful as well with some of our most vulnerable residents. And I think these are some of the details that I don't know if all of our city leaders had thought about in terms of what it would actually look like in the Milwaukee community.
What were your general reactions to the shooting that happened on Tuesday? And did this validate any of the concerns that you had?
Yeah, I would say my initial reaction was just heartbroken to know that because of this event, we lost a community member, we lost a resident at the hands of an out-of-state person. And it feels just in these initial hours that some of our city leaders are almost taking the side of the out-of-state cop against losing one of our own community members. And it's very frustrating, to say the least. So it's a mix of deep sadness and a broken heart mixed with a lot of frustration and anger. And I can't help but to think that this could have been avoided. It's my understanding that the man was unhoused. And we also know that last week there were sweeps downtown of unhoused folks and people had to find a place to go, I believe by Saturday before the RNC started. And then understanding that this was, again, an out-of-state cop. And two of those factors, easily this tragedy could have been avoided. It absolutely is connected to the RNC because of the failure in policies that were put in place to host this. I don't want to say I feel validated. It's just disappointing. And I think the frustration is rooted in the fact that so many community members, so many community members for months, since day one that we were listed as a finalist, had said, we don't want this. This is not good. This is not what our community needs.
Could you tell me a little bit more about King Park? And are you particularly active in that community?
The King Park area, I think, is a special area. And we find ourselves reminiscing about it in the office a lot of times, especially about when we were kids or we were younger in the 90s. Everybody would be there. Family members would be there. People were utilizing the center to play basketball. It felt very much in the 90s and in my childhood, a very much a part of just like a community center, a safe place for family and neighbors to kind of gather and have fun and have recreational time. And so Block, you know, we are in the area. We cover generally the north side of Milwaukee, including the King Park area. And every time I go there, whether it's for a meeting or to meet up with someone, it kind of brings back those fond memories. And now I think that area is just going to be forever changed. And that neighborhood is going to be forever changed.
When you have like a lot of people, like police force, come to an event this size, and they're in a city that they're not familiar with, what could be detrimental about that?
I think having outside law enforcement that's not familiar with the area or the residents or just the culture and norms can be the difference between a de-escalated situation or one that leads to gunshots and someone being killed. I think when there's an understanding of the neighborhood, you take a completely different approach. You understand the people. You may not be so quick to draw your gun right away because you know these faces. You've hopefully built up relationships with them and people are familiar. And there is already a deep, deep distrust with law enforcement in our own city, with the Milwaukee Police Department, and adding on other law enforcement who are strangers to us and that don't know our city and our residents and our people and our culture can just add to the fact that we're just another face to some of these cops. And if we're just another face to some of these cops, then who knows what can happen? They don't get a chance to know how to de-escalate conflict. They're there for a week and we're just another face and another body to them.
You mentioned in your answer about there's being an already an existing mistrust. How might this incident fit into that larger conversation about distrust?
I think people have been seeing distrust of law enforcement for quite some time. And I think a lot of organizations and a lot of people have started to talk about police funding, especially in the age where people were talking about defund or divest from law enforcement. And so while the detail is important that he was an out-of-state officer, when it comes to our rights being violated, it's just another member of state-sanctioned violence. You just happen to be out of town. And I think this does nothing to actually help community police relations, despite it being an out-of-town officer. We also understand that the local Milwaukee police chief has been a part of these conversations of how to keep our community safe. And quite frankly, he failed to do so. And so some of that responsibility goes on to our local police chief as well as our mayor and other local leaders that failed to keep the community safe during this week.
Is there anything that you feel is still like not being addressed by the city about the shooting at this point in time?
I think folks want to know why out-of-state cops who were here to patrol the security perimeter and provide extra support for the RNC were outside of the security perimeter. I think that is a huge question that the community deserves answers to, and specifically Sam Sharp's family deserve answers to. I'm interested in what does accountability look like? What does transparency look like? There is all sorts of body cam footage and videos out. What is the level of accountability? This can't be a, whoops, we made a mistake. Those police officers need to be held accountable. And I think the last thing is, I know that usually when there's an officer involved shooting, there's another police department that does the investigating in the outside police department. I believe with the amount of resources and politics and how this actually really impacts the whole state, I do believe that there needs to be a DOJ investigation, because so many law enforcement agencies, Secret Service, all of that was here. And what went wrong in the RNC planning and with that many law enforcement agencies, I think it warrants a Department of Justice investigation.
Angela Lang is the executive director of BLOC, Black Leaders Organizing for Our Communities. She spoke with WUWM Eric Vaughn Fellow Nadia Kelly. For more updates about the shooting, visit WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll learn about the GOP's founding right here in Wisconsin. That's next on Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. We're bringing you today's show from the Panther Arena on the final day of the Republican National Convention. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's been an especially popular place for people to snap photos this week at the RNC. It's a small white building that looks like an old-fashioned schoolhouse. It's set up on the convention grounds near booths selling fried cheese curds and frozen custard, of course. The building is a 1/3 scale replica of the so-called Little White Schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. That's a city in Wisconsin known as the birthplace of the Republican Party. Meetings held in the Little White Schoolhouse in 1854 led to the party's creation. Lily Gorin is professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. She shares with WUWM's Annalise Henzel how and why the Republican Party came to be formed in Ripon.
It was really founded upon the remnants of what would have been known at the time as the Whig Party, and also integrated some folks who were known as Free Soilers. And so the Whigs could not quite sort out what they wanted to do with regard to the issue of slavery. And the Republican Party, while not necessarily moving directly into an abolitionist mode, was opposed to some of the decisions that had made in the Kansas-Nebraska Compromise and also the Dred Scott decision with regard to extending slavery further west. So the early days of the Republican Party was really about sort of containing the extent of slavery and keeping it also out of essentially the northern states. And thus the Republican Party was dominated by people from the northern states or their northwestern states in the 1850s. And as I like to talk about with my students, because, you know, students are always asking about third parties in the United States and, you know, how come we don't have more parties in the United States? And I always say that the Republican Party is the most successful third-party movement in the United States history.
After that vote in Ripon, how did the rest of the states go about getting on board with the Republican Party, and how quickly did it spread?
If you start in 1854 and you elect a president who's part of your party in 1860, you actually did fairly well in 6 year time, which is exactly what happened. And since the Whigs had been active as a party that had kind of separated from the Democratic Party as a whole, because for a long time, everybody was a Democrat. They were just different kinds of Democrats in the Democratic Party. That essentially what happened with regard to the Republican Party is it sort of came in and built on the remnants of what had mostly been the Whig establishment, particularly in the northern and newly sort of developed western states, not too far west, Midwest, really. And so there was some structure that was already there, and some of the sort of format of what parties did at the time. They had drills, they had events, they had, you know, picnics. And that was really what happened with regard to the establishment of the Republican Party and then its movement and its spread across particularly the northern states.
Well, a lot of time has passed, and of course, the party has evolved. Could you touch on some of the key moments in the party's evolution, and how did it get from where it was in Ripon to what we see in the present day?
What you had was, following the Civil War, the Democratic Party was sort of contained within the South for the most part and drew most of its strength from white Southern voters. The Republican Party was situated, and again, in a regional way, in the northern states, as well as drawing, at least for a time after the Civil War, on newly enfranchised Black male voters. And this is when we have the first Black men elected to local and also national office. And so you have a Republican Party that, you know, comes out of the Civil War. You have much more, say, shall we say, radical Republicans in the legislature in the United States Congress following the war, and then necessarily either Abraham Lincoln at the time or after he was assassinated, Andrew Johnson. And these Republicans, in fact, moved to impeach Andrew Johnson because they did not trust him and they did not like the way he was conducting business. And so you sort of have a beachhead of the Republican Party, particularly in the North and the Midwestern states during this period of time. And the most of the time having Republicans elected to the White House, because there just weren't enough electoral college votes coming from the southern states, although it's not exactly all the time during this period. But what happens is the Republican Party itself, you know, it keeping with this sort of tradition of economic liberty, is more and more engaged in this sort of these questions of the free market and what we consider to be sort of the Wall Street dimensions of the economy. And so as the Republican Party evolved during this period of time, you had some blips of reform with Republican President Teddy Roosevelt, who was also considered to be a progressive and ultimately left the Republican Party. And then you have the so-called three presidents that came in between Woodrow Wilson and FDR, who were all Republicans and very much free market Republicans, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And then you get to the Great Depression and the New Deal and FDR, and you have a reconfiguration to some degree of the parties that includes a reconfiguration of, to a degree, the voters who had been in the Republican Party. And so the New Deal coalition sort of narrows the Republican Party during this time. And then you have a stretch of time following the New Deal where there's a Democratic sort of presidency as well as Democratic hold on both the houses of Congress. But you do continue to have a very solid Democratic South, as it was known at the time. But what starts to happen in the 1960s and 1970s is you begin to have some cracks, obviously cracks in the New Deal coalition, as well as some shifts in terms of the allegiance of white Democratic voters in the South. And the solid Democratic South evolves and ultimately shifts into the Republican Party, particularly in the 1980s, with the election of Ronald Reagan and sort of the rise of the Republican Revolution of the 1980s. And so what you have, you know, from the 1860s is you have a long stretch of time where the Republicans were in lots of elected offices. And then you have a shift in terms of the Democrats who were in a lot of elected offices after 1932. And then since the 1980s, you've seen the sort of very, very tight elections in many places because the ideological dimensions of the parties have sorted into making more sense internally in the parties, and they don't include as many sort of cross-ideological compatriots anymore. And so the Republican Party is much more conservative consistently. The Democratic Party tends to be more liberal consistently these days. And the conservatives who had been in the Democratic Party have left it and moved into the Republican Party.
So turning back to the Little White Schoolhouse, would people who were there for the vote that got the Republican Party started recognize the party today if they were to drop in at the convention this week?
I'm not totally sure that they would in some respects, because what you're seeing now with regard to the Republican Party and the Republican Party platform looks like a much more constrained approach to market economics. And it's not necessarily as clear that the party itself is committed to, you know, the sort of freedom of labor to move around in the United States and for all individuals to be treated equally, which was, at least as the Republican Party evolved, something that it was also committed to.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. She spoke with WUWM's Annalise Henzel. And that's Lake Effect for today here from the Panther Arena in downtown Milwaukee. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, X-Grit Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also had support from every person on the WUWM news team this week. A special thanks to our studio engineer, Jason Reavy, for helping us out in the Panther Arena this week. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. They were assisted by WUWM editor Emily Files in producing a live RNC blog in partnership with NPR this week. You can find that on our website through the week. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon, where we'll get a wrap-up of this week's convention and what takeaways there might be politically and for the city. Plus, we'll speak with a ProPublica reporter who looked into how a Milwaukee-area militant anti-abortion activist is influencing Republican politics. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.